Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Welcome to episode 27 of Blue Jays Happy Hour. I'm Nick Ashbourn, joined as always by Andrew Stoughton. And today we've brought on a guest, Sam Dykstra of MLB Pipeline, to talk with us about the Arizona Fall League and Gabriel Moreno. Stoughton, I feel like early in our podcast we were notorious for rambling about Alek Manoah, and that generally came good in the end, but it might have served us to have someone on the podcast who actually knew their prospects instead of us just, speculating and scouting the stat line. So we've learned our lesson this time.
I think that will be helpful, yeah.
There's a surprising amount of Blue Jays news this week. Again, like every week I kind of expect it's going to be a dry spell and we're going to have nothing to discuss and I don't know where we're going to go with it, but every week things just seem to happen that, you know, I don't know if that's going to continue all off season.
Especially. I mean, I think there's going to be a couple months where there's where we're talking about collective bargaining, but okay, yeah.
But yeah, so far so good. And we're going to get to some of the Berríos stuff later in the show, but I think we got to start with the whole MVP and Cy Young's coming down. Robbie Ray has won the Cy Young. I know on this show, I showed some support for Gerrit Cole, which was probably not appreciated by virtually any of the listeners. But not only did Robbie Ray win, and I expected Ray to win at this point, he won by a handy margin there. The old 29-1, virtually a unanimous Cy Young win. Were you also taken aback by how decisive that was?
Absolutely, yeah. I thought there was like strong arguments for Cole. Like, the Fangraphs version of WAR. I know people are weird with FIP sometimes, but there's a reason that that's a thing. And I think he was like eighth in the American League in Fangraphs version of WAR. Baseball Reference, he was ahead by quite a lot. Obviously, the ERA was great. The strikeouts were great. The innings were great. Led the league in all those things. I thought that definitely some people would, especially with the Yankees making the playoffs, that's becoming less and less of a thing in terms of award voting than it was, 20 years ago or 10 years ago even. I thought that definitely it would be a little bit more mixed than that, which is to Jason Beck, the chagrin of the Tigers, MLB.com guy, who was the one lone dissenter on Robbie Ray and voted for Cole, and then took a bunch of heat for it, because apparently people go nuts about awards, which is very weird to me. He unfortunately was like the only one who went that way, but that was surprising. And I don't know why anybody would be... would take that stance and be mad at the one guy who did a thing that we expected a lot more other people to do.
Yeah, and I think Jason Beck deserves some credit for being forthright about it, right? We often find whether it's award voting, sometimes Hall of Fame
Hall
voting.
Hall of Fame is the weird one,
there'll be
one, yeah.
Some like truly bizarre shit that comes through and we never get to find out who it was who did it.
Yeah.
And so Beck recognized the situation like, oh, I'm the sole dissenter. This is something people are going to think about. And I'm going to be transparent about the fact it was me. And I think it was valid. I kind of expected going in, you know, Ray had all the sort of traditional stats, for lack of a better term. I know maybe not wins, but people don't really care. I don't know. I haven't even looked at the wins leaderboard. Maybe he did have wins.
Yeah, I have no idea.
So, yeah, I might be talking on my ass. Anyway, he had the innings. He had the strikeouts. He had the ERA. You know what I mean? Like, I felt like all of the sort of less statistically inclined voters, for lack of a better term, were going to pretty much march in line behind Ray. And then I figured that the other voters, based on some of the other stuff that Cole had and sort of the, you know, strikeout walks, FIP, contact management, that type of stuff, I thought that they would split, maybe still favoring Ray, but you'd get something like 75 to 85% of voters going for Ray. And yeah, it's pretty exciting to see him win by that big a margin. I think it also hammers home how memorable this season is going to be. And we don't know what's going to happen with Robbie Ray in terms of him coming back. I know a lot of people have predicted him coming back. But it's kind of cool, the idea that this is just this one moment in time where you get to appreciate one of the most improbable Cy Youngs we can remember, right? Like, you know, there's things like R.A. Dickey winning a Cy Young kind of pop to mind as one of those ones that you never would have predicted. I'm not going to say this is sort of truly unprecedented in baseball. People kind of come from nowhere and find that adjustment more than they do in, say, basketball or the NHL or something like that. But this one does stand out. Like, this is one that if in the middle of the 2020 season, someone had told you, while Ray was pitching for the Diamondbacks and pitching poorly, someone had said, you know who's going to win the Cy Young next year? It's Robbie Ray. You would have been pretty dumbfounded by that take.
I think so, yeah. Though, I mean, he does, you know, he's had some pretty good seasons on his track record. But yeah, he was not in a great spot. And credit to him, credit to Pete Walker, credit to Matt Bushman and all the other, you know, whoever else the Jays have working on this stuff, which I think goes beyond one guy, though he often tends to get the credit, which isn't to say he doesn't deserve plenty of credit as well, but also credit to Robbie Ray. And it's a bit of a shame that he's a free agent right now. And it's, you know, I think were he clearly going to be coming back for the Jays next year, I think maybe there would have been a little bit more of a more fanfare about it. Or maybe I just slept through it. I don't know. But it felt to me like it wasn't quite as the fan base was maybe as rabid about this one as the Vlad one, for example, because obviously he's a guy who's going to be around for a very long time.
And has been around, you know, he's young in his career, but also we've been hearing about Vlad forever, right? So he feels like this Blue Jays institution, even though he's only 22 years old. Whereas Ray, you know, he definitely got fans to his side. You know, he got the tight pants going. His performance was incredible.
Pants pioneer.
Yeah, exactly. so, no, but I'm sure that Blue Jays fans are attached to him. But it's a different situation. Like, Vladdy's a whole different thing. And it was interesting because neither of the results were a surprise. Like, I don't think that many people honestly believed that Vladdy was going to win the MVP. And then again, you got the almost unanimous, although who really cares about unanimous second place?
Right.
Like, I saw some people like, oh, I can't believe that Vladdy didn't get second place. Like, I can't imagine someone. I know that I'm pretty confident that Vladdy doesn't care that someone voted for Sal Perez. Like, I'd say I'm 99.9% confident that Vladdy isn't losing sleep over winning unanimous second place in the MVP vote.
So, I mean, and Sal Perez had a great season. And honestly, you could, I don't know. I am intrigued by the argument that a catcher should probably win every year just because of how important they are on the field.
Yeah, I could
maybe
see
don't
someone
capture their value as well as, you know, Buster Posey should have won every year he was in the league, kind of a thing.
Here's a guy who's a catcher with a great defensive reputation. I know that the framing numbers were really bad. But a great defensive reputation and hits 48 home runs. It's easy to see someone take that package and say, you know what, that's a pretty unique, like, in a year full of unique years, that's a pretty unique year, you know? Like,
it would have been better maybe if it wasn't, you know, the Kansas City Star writer, but yeah.
Yeah, it might have been a little bit better. Yeah, those situations are always very odd when you get sort of the hometown writer who's like, I'm the one who's really seen and appreciated, or just, you know, more blatantly trying to curry favor. I don't know what goes into a vote like that. I am trying to justify it, but, like, realistically, it had to be Ohtani 1, Vladdy 2 on your ballot. And there was a time in the year when Vladdy was really challenging Ohtani, despite the fact Ohtani was doing the special thing, because Vladdy's hitting was so good. But that kind of August dip was enough to, yeah, to take him out of consideration for that. And I think that's totally fair.
Yeah, and I people got weird about Otani because it's like, oh, it's like it's not fair somehow. that people are using the word valuable to mean, oh, the amount of value that he provided, which is on both sides of the ball. Like, sorry, it's so strange to be mad about the guy who had just such an incredible season winning the award. But also, and I was talking to somebody about this on Twitter, like, you can literally just add up his wins above replacement on both sides of the ball, right? Like, I think he was a 3-win pitcher and a 5-win hitter, according to Fangraphs. So, you know, 9 wins. Vlad had, like, 6 and change. But also 9 wins, you know, there's, I think Mookie Betts was over 10 a couple years ago. Jacob deGrom was over 10 in 2018. You know, it's not like, oh, this is so unfair, Otani will always win. It's like, I don't know. There will definitely, presumably, be years where, even adding those two things combined, there's somebody who is better on one side of the ball alone.
Yeah, I wouldn't rule out Mike Trout.
He made his teammate, exactly, yeah. So I don't know. Yeah, I think Vlad has lots of time to win another MVP award. That's not really what they play the game for. He had a great season. It's not disparaging to him to be second. Otani was amazing. Enjoy it. Enjoy living in the world that Otani exists in as well.
Yeah, the idea of penalizing him for being so good that he does something that other people can't possibly fathom
right.
Doesn't seem like a logical way to go about it. Yeah, I think as much as we appreciate Otani, we probably don't even appreciate him enough. And that's insane to say. It's like ranking someone 99 in a sports game and saying they should be they're underrated because they should be 100. But that's kind of what the appreciation of Otani is like. Like, this is truly something. And we also don't know how long it's going to last. Like, I'd like to believe that for 10 years, Otani does this. And hell, if he wins the MVP every year, more power to him. But, you know, we've seen him encounter health problems in the past. We are in kind of uncharted waters with him. And so I think it's okay to be like, oh, this is an unbelievable thing that happened, and treat it as such, because, yeah, it's definitely not a given that this is going to be the new norm forever. Like, Otani might end up being a guy who, let's say he has some arm problems, and I don't want any of this to happen.
Right.
But let's say he has some arm problems and doesn't end up pitching in the future, and he's sort of like a 4-5-win outfielder. And, like, that would be a very good player, and the Angels would be happy to have him, but he wouldn't be this sort of overarching narrative that hangs over the entire league. He would just be like another really cool superstar, of which there are many in this era in baseball.
Yeah, it'd be nice. It'd be nice to see him make the playoffs one time, maybe. Trout as well. I mean, he's got a couple games, but yeah.
Trout has the precedence for that. He's the guy who deserves to make it. Anyway, I could talk about Otani and Trout for quite a while, but that is not what people tune into this podcast for. They tune in for Blue Jays analysis, so we're going to turn that over to our guest this week, Sam Dykstra. Sam, thank you for joining us. We need to discuss Gabriel Moreno because, you know, he's been outstanding throughout 2021 in a year where the Blue Jays traded away prospects. I think he's one that fans have really started to focus on. And this Arizona Fall League performance is really impressive on paper. But, you know, we're not there. I think sometimes it's too easy to scout the stat line and assume that something amazing is happening. And that's not always the case. What I want to know is, what has this Arizona Fall League performance from Moreno shown us maybe that we didn't know coming into it, or has it shown us anything at all?
Well, first off, thanks so much for having me on, guys. This is great. I think, first off, the biggest thing that it's shown us about Moreno is just, what does he look like now? A big thing for Moreno was he really broke out at AA New Hampshire earlier in the year, suffered a fractured thumb, and then we didn't get to see him for a while. He had a very, very brief cameo at AAA at the end of the year, but how was the back going to hold up coming off that injury? And was it just small sample size noise at New Hampshire, or you know, was the plus to plus plus hit tool that we saw with the Fisher Cats real? What we've seen in the fall league backs up everything that we saw over the summer. He's answered a lot of questions, particularly with his ability to spray the ball into the gaps and all over the place, produce high exit velocities. So the Gabriel Moreno we thought we saw in the summer has carried over to the fall, and that's been a huge bonus in how we evaluate him and who we think he can be going forward.
When you're looking at players in the Arizona Fall League, how is the quality of competition complicate that? Because when you're looking at, you know, single A, double A, whatever the level is, it's not that every team to team is going to be totally consistent or player to player, but they're there for a very, you know, specific band of readiness and talent. And it seems like the Arizona Fall League is a little bit more of a mixed bag. So when you're looking at what Moreno's doing there, how do you kind of factor in who he's up against and how that can vary?
Yeah, I mean, typically people like to ask me this question of how do you view the fall league on that kind of, like you said, low A, high A, double A, triple A spectrum. Typically, I like to think of it as kind of a midpoint between double A and triple A. We like to call it the prospect finishing school. A lot of guys are sent here as, hey, go compete against other top prospects, get to know that environment. And you know, hopefully we'll have you up next year. I think this year is a little bit different. I think this year there's more guys who are trying to make up at bats like a Moreno or make up innings, because 2021 was a weird season. It was great to have minor league baseball back, but a lot of these guys weren't playing on a regular basis in 2020. There were some injuries that happened, some freak ones like Moreno's, but still. So it isn't just top prospects. There are guys trying to complete their minor league cycle to become major leaguers. It's more filled with even lower level guys. You know, speaking of somebody in the Blue Jays system, Leo Jimenez fits that bill pretty well. He didn't really play in the upper minors at all, and he's there to make up at bats. There's more of those guys than I think in a typical year. But still, for Moreno to do this as well as he has and perform as well as he has, again, if it's around that double A level instead of midway between double A and triple A, it's still solidifying what we thought we saw when he was, you know, with the Fisher Cats in the summer.
One of the things when you're evaluating catcher, and this is a very difficult thing to do even at the big league level, is sort of looking at defensively game calling, how they work with the staff. Is that really difficult to do in a context like this where the teammates are people you've been thrown together with from different organizations potentially and not people you work with over a long period of time? Or on the flip side, do you maybe get a good sense of what guys can do on that side of it because it's a more difficult situation?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. It's one of my favorite things to talk to catchers playing in the fall league, because normally in your regular season, you are catching everybody who's in your organization. There's an organizational plan. You know who that is. You're probably catching the same guys, you know, every week in and week out for weeks and months at a time. It's so much more of a rotating basis in the fall league. It's a little tougher to evaluate like how game calling is working, because you're trying to balance, okay, if you're a pitcher, you're here to maybe work on your curveball. And if I'm a Blue Jays catcher, maybe that's something we don't typically throw or whatever. It's really getting thrown into the fire. I don't look into it too hard of like, oh, they really seem to not be on the same page. Of course that's going to happen. I mean, that it almost feels like exhibitions every day in that way of learning guys and that aspect. I look more towards blocking and receiving and arm strength, like the measurable tools. How do those hold up? But, you know, it's always a bonus if a guy can come out the other side and pitchers are naming a catcher saying, hey, I really like throwing to this guy. Logan O'Hoppe in the Philly system has been brought up multiple times as somebody fall league pitchers like to throw to so far this autumn. And I think that can work. I just don't really factor it in that much just because there are so many variables at play there.
That makes sense. I think it's pretty clear that everyone sees Gabriel Moreno's greatest value as being a catcher. That's part of what makes him a special prospect, is that he has the defensive abilities behind the plate. But what do you make of him getting some work at third base? And I don't know if you saw any of that. Like, what do you see out of that, him being out in the infield, and what does that say about his kind of athleticism overall?
Yeah, unfortunately, I didn't get eyes on him myself at third base when I was down there. But that being said, I've talked to Jonathan Mayo, who's been down there for a little bit, and he's kind of been updating me on what Moreno looks like at third when he catches him. And he said he made a nice play there the other day. He has the arm strength for it. I think that's why you're doing it. I think if Moreno was playing in almost any other system, he wouldn't be doing this right now. Trying out third base, yes, versatility is great. Every team loves to preach versatility. But looking at the Blue Jays catching situation right now with Jansen and Kirk and McGuire, trying to figure those guys out, and Moreno likely will be major league ready in the first half, giving him another opportunity to win a third base spot. I mean, that's a big question mark right now on the Blue Jays roster. Maybe that's the easiest way in for him. I don't think he necessarily has the speed to cover, you know, to have the range for third base, but he has the arm. And if he can be just okay there and you can find a way to get his bat in the lineup every day, it's worth a shot. They can try it. I still think he's a good enough defensive catcher to kind of elbow his way past those other guys and create a role behind the plate at the major league level. But give him a look there. Maybe he surprises some folks, and we'll definitely be watching more as he expands that sample size going into the spring.
You stole a little bit of what I wanted to ask next, and I think, to be honest, what a lot of Blue Jays fans are thinking, which is, how close to MLB ready does he seem? And if you're saying you can see it in sort of the first half of 2022, what are the, let's call them, the hurdles that he'd have to get over between now and then to reach that? And I know that there's no uniform definition of MLB readiness, but to reach what you would classify as MLB readiness, putting aside all service time manipulation, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's a major question mark right now in terms of service time, just because of, we don't know what the CBA is going to look like coming out of this. Is service time going to be a consideration for when you call up players, on the hush-hush side in terms of, he needs more work at AAA and we'll call him up when we can gain an extra year of free agency? That might not be even part of the equation in 2022. So I'm going to kind of put that off to the side. But in terms of major league readiness with Moreno specifically, it's just at bats. I mean, he didn't get that many at bats this summer because of the injury. He's making up for it now. There's reports that he's going to head down to the Venezuelan Winter League after this, so he's going to make up for more at bats there. But he only got a short cameo at AAA. He needs to see that level over a longer period of time. The reason why I say I think he's major league ready in the first half is because some of the measurables we're getting off of him are akin to what major leaguers are doing. You look at his exit velocities. He had the hardest hit ball in the Fall Stars game at 107.9 miles an hour. Yeah, it was an out, but it took an incredible defensive play to make it happen. He was regularly putting up mid, 105, 106, 107 in the spring. His pop times are decent. His arm strength is good. All the pieces are there. He just needs to show it on a more regular basis before I think the Jays are comfortable enough to call him up. But because all the tools are there, all the excitement is there, it wouldn't surprise me if it's May or June, just once he gets playing every day back at Buffalo, and it can really solidify his health and just ability to be consistent week in and week out.
The reports that we tend to hear on Moreno are kind of consistent with what you just said there, in terms of he's kind of checking all the boxes. Like, this is a guy who can help on the offensive side and the defensive side of the game. What do you think are really the standout skills? Like, what are the things that he's best at? Or is it better to conceptualize him as a guy who does everything well as opposed to a couple of things at an outstanding level?
I mean, for me, it's the bat. It's the bat that's going to stand out most. Maybe that's just because, we all exist in an environment where we pay more attention to offense. But I think the hit tool has a real chance to be plus-plus. It's just been incredible what he was able to do at New Hampshire, batting .373 over 32 games. Again, a small sample, but the fact that he's backing it up so far in the Fall League, ranking right up there among the doubles leaders, despite missing the first week of Fall League play. I love watching him hit. I if you ever get a chance to watch him hit and watch minor league highlights or some of the stuff coming out of the Fall League, what he does with his elbow is really interesting. It's a lot of moving parts, but he's always right in sync, right when the pitch is coming in. And that allows him to drive the ball deep to gaps and all over the yard. I think the power is a little bit behind the hit tool right now. but I think it could be there. He could be a 25 homer guy when it's all said and done. So yeah, the defense I think will be fine. I think it's going to be able to, you know, get him to the major leagues and stick a catcher, but I think it's the hit tool that's going to make him super exciting as a major leaguer and potentially a future all-star.
If we're setting out to be pessimistic, which you don't know, but Stoughton knows about me, is a little bit my disposition. How would things go in a world where things go wrong with Gabriel Moreno, other than sort of catastrophic injury, which can happen to anyone? How do things go wrong? Like, where are the holes in his game potentially?
Well, so that's the thing, is that I don't want to say catastrophic injury is a chance that could happen, but he is a catcher. Catching prospects are notoriously difficult to kind of project. There's a lot of wear and tear when you're back there all the time. Anything can kind of happen. You go back to Matt Wieters is kind of the classic example. Matt Wieters had not a great major league career, but a good major league career. He was around for a while, but he was somebody, you know, kind of before my time in the prospect world. But I remember covering.
He was not better than sliced bread, it turns out.
Yeah, exactly. And everybody was saying, you know, this guy can really defend, he can really hit, he can really do all these things. And he got to the major league level and was average in his best years. That's kind of difficult to swallow. And I think just because you are back there all the time, there are so many things you need to do as a catcher that even if you do them average, it can look bad because you're hitting 220 all of a sudden. I don't think Moreno's going to be that guy. I do think the hit tool is good enough and it's held up for long enough, dating back to even 2019. But if that's where something's going to go wrong with him, it's just because he is a catcher. Crazy things happen to catchers. They all can't be Buster Posey's, Lord knows. And that's where I would kind of keep an eye on. It's just what is his wear and tear, and how does that kind of drag down the offensive profile?
I mean, the Blue Jays haven't developed a catcher since Pat Borders. So, so yeah, we get that for sure.
Yes, and the catcher of the future grind north of the 49th parallel has been a long
current run. Current crop is actually not so bad, though.
I was going to say, yeah, because like we could have had this very same conversation, not at this level. Trust me, I was not as high on this guy as I am as Moreno, but like Alejandro Kirk had a lot of momentum going into last year.
And, for sure.
And everybody thought he was going to be the kind of catcher of the future. And talking about wear and tear, like guy played 60 games this year. And that kind of dulled the profile now. And now we're looking at the next guy. I mean, that's life in prospectum, really. It's always who's the next guy. You can't be satisfied with what you have. But that's kind of prime example of what I'm talking about.
Yeah, here. For sure. Danny Jansen before him, too, was a top 100 guy.
Right, right. I remember talking to Danny Jansen at the Futures game and thinking this guy can really solidify himself as the Blue Jays catcher of the future. And, you know, he very well might. He still could. It's his job to lose.
Yeah, I think they love him, actually. So, yeah, very much so.
Sam, before we let you go, just wondering if there's any other... Moreno has taken up so much oxygen in the Blue Jays world, and for good reason. Like you point out, this is the type of prospect whose biggest concern is the position he plays rather than the skills that he has. Is there anything else in Blue Jays Arizona Fall League that we have missed that the Blue Jays fans should know about while they've been focusing on their players losing out on unanimous award votes by one and everything that's happened with Moreno?
Yeah, I know, right? Like, you have Robbie Ray, and then you have two of your players finish in the top three for AL MVP. It's not a bad life, I would imagine, out there right now. But in terms of other guys who have kind of made me pay attention, Graham Spraker, a reliever, he only really throws fastballs. It's really interesting to watch him throw. He throws about mid-90s. He will mix in kind of a slider cutter. It's more of a cutter now because it's sitting around 90 miles an hour. But he just spots the ball really well, and AFL guys have found it really difficult to square up, which is saying something because the pitching has been really down in the AFL. Normally it's a hitter's league anyways, but especially this year, hitters have thrived more. So Graham Spraker looks like a potential relief piece for Toronto. And the other one I'll throw out is Spencer Horwitz, who I haven't checked today's numbers, but I know the other day was leading the AFL in batting average. He's first base only, so there's some questions there. He's not going to be a huge power guy, but Spencer Horwitz is making me pay attention more than I was expecting coming in. Cause I thought I was only going to be looking really at Moreno and Jimenez and he's commanding attention.
Yeah. I think it's fair to say most Blue Jays observers are inclined to not pay attention to first base only guys these days.
Right.
When you've got a 22-year-old Vladdy, but you never know who's going to be a trade piece. You never know. You never know what happens to Vladdy. I mean, I guess you do know that he'll be the starter for a while. Let's not put that out into the universe.
I was going to go the other way and say maybe he magically learns third base again and becomes really good over there. Swing back the optimistic direction.
I'm okay with that.
That has been discussed a lot over the last year. I'd be surprised, but he's still got the arm, if nothing else. Sam, we really appreciate you coming on. Like I said before, I feel like sometimes we're kind of spitballing about prospects without an educated viewpoint, so it's really good to tap into one today. And thanks again for coming on and tuning us into what's going on with Moreno.
Yeah, anytime. Thanks so much for having me.
It's good to have someone kind of reassure you that the hype about the prospect you've been hearing about is legit. You know what I mean? Like, it's so easy for there to be kind of groupthink and people. And, you know, I have an article that should be up on Sportsnet by the time you guys listen to this that's about Moreno. And spoiler alert, it's pretty optimistic, especially for me. So it is good to know that, you know, it's not just a Blue Jays Toronto bubble thing. I mean, the prospect lists show you that level of respect, right? But it's good to hear from other observers that what you're seeing and what you're hearing about is about as legitimate as it gets.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that was good. Lots of great stuff there. It's a very interesting swing. I'm glad we got to that with Sam. The moving parts in the elbow, and you know, he's got the bat on his shoulder at one point, you know, but it works. The bat's where it needs to be when the ball's crossing the plate. So, pretty exciting stuff. It was almost though, you know, not brake pumping, but I've definitely seen people out there being like, oh, you got to move him to third base because the bat's just so good that you got to, you know, you can't let him be a catcher because of, you know, the attrition rates and whatever. And I don't know if he's that guy. You know, he's not. We're not talking about Vlad here. Like a 25 homer guy, that's great with good contact. You know, lots to love about the bat. But I think it's a bat that plays as a catcher more than a bat that you have to get in the lineup no matter where you possibly can. So we should switch him to somewhere else.
Yeah, I mean, the reward for him being that a catcher is so high. Like catchers don't hit particularly well. And you know, the piece I'm doing that's coming out on Friday is sort of about guys that Baseball America has tabbed as a top 10 prospect who are catchers, and they've been doing it since 1990, and they very rarely put catchers there, and it's for all the reasons that Sam outlined, right? Mm-hmm. Because they're worried about the attrition, the injuries that can pile up, the way that can, you know, physically break down their athleticism and stuff like that. And as a result, the guys who break through into that top 10, which Moreno is at last writing of the list, end up including some very special guys like, you know, Buster Posey, like Ivan Rodriguez, like, you know, Joe Mauer. I mean, obviously, I'm not saying Moreno's any of that, but very few real busts. Like some of the worst players that are in that list are guys like Michael Barrett, who still ended up being decent, you know, everyday catchers, or Matt Wieters. Like, if Matt Wieters is kind of the, like, I don't know, I even thought that Sam was maybe in a little bit low on what Matt Wieters was early in his career. He had some really good seasons. If Gabriel Moreno is Matt Wieters, I don't think the Blue Jays are too disappointed.
No, I think that's fair. I mean, or Michael Barrett, as long as, you know, AJ Pierzynski's around to get punched in the face.
And with maybe some defensive ability whatsoever.
Also, that would probably be good.
Michael Barrett was pretty bad back there. Anyway, it feels like, at least chronologically, we've buried the lead a little bit in this episode because the whole Jose Berríos extension happened. Now, I think it's okay for us to bury the lead because, you know, we know you, the listener, obviously, you listen to the whole thing, you're loyal, you get it, so it's okay to put it down here. but yeah, that's a thing that happened, and it's pretty you know, it's a pretty significant move for the Blue Jays. The reaction was pretty broadly positive, Stoughton. Like, I don't think I can't think of a single piece that I saw that was like, this is a bad idea. Like, you know what I mean? Like, there wasn't much dissent on this one.
Yeah, that was kind of remarkable, but also, you know, if you can't bet on Barrios, you know, if you're going to give a seven, it is a long contract for a pitcher, and that usually would spark people being very concerned about things. But it, like, he's 27 and he's been as durable as anybody, and you know that there's always a chance that a pitcher, you know, injuries happen. But if you can't bet on him, you can't bet on anybody. So hell yeah, go bet on him. And just his. All the positivity about Toronto and about the organization, and it was a good moment for the Blue Jays. Even though, yeah, it's, you know, objectively you do think 7-year contracts for pitchers, but it's a long time. Though also the opt out kind of makes it really interesting as well. Like a lot of that was, I think, a great part of it is that like a lot of it, the Shai Davidi had the piece at Sportsnet last on Thursday night about how it all came together and the opt out after year 5. A bunch of the money is after that, and it was kind of like a fail-safe in case the Blue Jays like pivot and tear down quickly somehow, because you know I think Vlad and Bo will be free agents by that point as well, and it was more or at least cast in this piece more about him wanting to be somewhere, not wanting to be in a situation where they're rebuilding and wanting to make sure that they're still a winning team, you know, 5 years into it, which is like. Hell yeah, man. That's how do you not want that kind of guy on your team?
That makes sense to me, especially in the context of how the Blue Jays contracts and roster is constructed. I do think that there's some misunderstanding about an opt-out. Like, an opt-out benefits the player. Like, I think a lot of people think, oh, well, you'll get 5 years, and those are the cheapest years, and those are the best years, and it's going to work out great for the Blue Jays. Yeah, but if there wasn't an opt-out, like, if the opt-out is good value from that point on, then the player is going to, he's going to leave, which means the team has lost those years on what would have been good value. And if it's not good value, he's going to stay, which means you're paying a player that's not good value.
Sure. So, but also, if he opts out, that means the contract to that point has gone very well.
But it would have gone better. Like, if he opts out, then the rest of the contract would have gone even better. You know what I mean? Potentially, or at least in the view at that moment in time. It, like I said, it is complicated by the roster dynamics that you've described. But I do think that a lot of times fans see that opt-out and they think, oh, that's great. The money is after the opt-out and he'll be young enough and maybe he'll just leave and the first 5 worked out great. But we have to remember that, like, that is for the player. And the contract as a whole is actually probably worth less money. Well, it's not probably. It is worth less money because the opt-out is included. Like, that's a discount that Barrios is giving the Blue Jays so that he has that flexibility.
For sure. Absolutely. But yeah, I don't know. I think that the idea that that it was more about about the state of the team rather than money, which was why I guess they were comfortable backloading it to that extent, is kind of cool. I thought that, you know, enjoy that, and hopefully he pitches great and doesn't opt out. You know, it's still going to be like what, like 2 years, $48 million at the point where he's in his early 30s or whatever it is. I don't know. Even just based on his track record, like, that's not going to kill you. You know, we were already, you know, Noah Syndergaard's pitched 2 innings in the last like 2 seasons.
You know, and Barrios is about the polar opposite of Noel. Like, he's the exact opposite guy as Noel, as Syndergaard.
Sure, but, you know, the teams are still paying big money for risky bets, you know, for short term. And I doubt that will change by 2025 or whenever the hell, 2026, whenever the opt-out actually happens.
And I think also the 7-year deal, that stands out. Like, oh, 7 years for a pitcher. But realistically, if you'd sign him to a 6-year deal in free agency after this year, I don't think that would have had the same level of kind of commitment shock.
Right.
So it's just. But
think there was much commitment shock. I think.
No, there wasn't. It was very, in the discourse.
Very positive. Yeah.
And so, I mean, that is kind of surprising to me. But yeah, you're going to get value every year. I guess if I had to complain about the structure of the contract, it does seem a little bit odd that it's getting more expensive as the other players are getting more expensive. Mm-hmm. Like, if anything, you kind of tend to do a deal like this when you feel like this moment is the exact moment. So that's good news, because it means, you know, the Blue Jays are paying him in 2021 basically what they would have paid him anyway through arbitration, a little less. So that right. tells me, like, oh, they're going to spend in 2021. Like, this is not really going to affect what they do this year, especially on short-term deals. But it is the case that as Vladdy, as Bo gets more expensive, potentially Teoscar Hernandez, we don't know what's going to happen with the extension there or whatever, he's going to get more expensive too. And in a way, you might have been able to do a version where he gets, like they did with Grichuk, where his contract dipped a little bit, kind of at a strategic point.
I think Springer as well. I think Springer this year was like $29 million and it dips again.
Like, I like those kind of structures. But again, like, that is so nitpicky to get in on it at that level, because this is a good contract. If you're going to bet on anybody, this is a guy to bet on, not just in terms of, like you said, as a guy, you know, his nickname is The Machine, for God's sake. But like his production too, like you don't even have to know anything about the guy. You could just take a look at his Fangraphs page or his Baseball Reference page, whatever you want to do. His level of consistency and durability is truly ridiculous. Like it is, you know, I don't know, predicting the future is always tough, but if you're going to do it, this is the guy who you feel like you know what you're going to get from him. And that, like, it's very different than Ryu, for instance, who was pretty high variance. And we saw kind of the ups, and this year we saw a little bit of the downs of that. And it's a similar, you know, average annual value on that. This is the guy where you're like, yep, pencil him in. That's a two, and it's going to be a good two.
I think so, yeah. I mean, you know, for some reason I'm reminded of Marcus Stroman here as well, which I guess maybe for other reasons. They did not want to have around, but there's another guy who you could say similar things about, durable and consistent and whatever. But moving beyond that, as to the structure, I think that you're right. It is weird that it does escalate as it sort of goes on, but also like next winter is sort of the big deal, and it's still low there, right? Because next winter you still have the Grichuk money and the Ryu money on your books. And then even though other guys are getting more expensive, Teoscar, Bo, Vlad, afterwards, I think next year is maybe, it's a concern. Or it's not like, you know, it's not like the hugest thing. And also, you know, any like financial stuff, like the important thing to underline that is underneath everything is, you know, of course Rogers could pay more and could just do it. So, you know, it's people get weird about, oh, we're talking about contracts and you know, you're letting the billionaires off the hook and, you know, a little bit. But also, I don't know, the Blue Jays have a particular budget and this is how we do this.
Yeah, we're speaking within the confines of what they expect, what we expect them to spend. And I don't think that's unfair. We're not like, it would be great to see them spend more and they could run, you know, they could run the highest payroll in the entire league. And that would be fantastic and paradigm changing. And we would have a very different conversation about virtually any free agent. But I don't think it's saying, oh, it's okay that they run the payroll they do, or they should keep a low payroll, they should try not to pay players, to just be realistic about what we kind of know about the franchise and what they're likely to do.
Right. Absolutely. And so, I don't know. So next year, next winter, potentially very tricky because they'll have Berríos now, and Ryu, and Grichuk, and Springer, and Teoscar in his last year of ARB. Bo will be in his first year. Vlad will be in year two of four. But the Teoscar and Vlad, I think, are going to get, you know, combined to be almost $30 million. Plus, presumably, there's going to be more money on the books for next year that's going to come in the form of somebody that they acquire this offseason. So that's getting them into unprecedented territory. So I get why maybe there wasn't, like, I don't know, it wasn't as the way they structured it. It's sort of like, well, we'll deal with the finances down the road, kind of a thing.
When I see the way this contract structured, and it's undoubtedly been in the works for some time, so I think that they kind of probably went into the off season, basically. I mean, I wouldn't say they necessarily had this in place, but basically having an idea of what they wanted to do here, because this is a, you know, this is a building block at this point.
Sure. I mean, I don't think you make that trade unless you think you're, you know, unless you're thinking about extending it.
So. When I hear that they're, and again, we're going to peddle in rumors a lot on this podcast because that's the price of doing business over the next couple of months. But when I hear they are in on pitchers like Syndergaard or Verlander who end up signing one-year contracts, it's not the wildest thing to me to think that maybe they thought it was a good idea to have Barrios at his relatively low cost and then use that as an opportunity to spend big on a one-year contract that doesn't bleed into that the next winner that you're describing that could be a financial challenge, not financial challenge for them, but whatever, however you want to phrase that, which is interesting, sort of the idea of getting someone on a one. Now, the Angels took a lot of flack for signing Syndergaard to a one-year deal where it seems like they're taking all the risk and not getting the potential value. But I wonder about maybe Verlander in particular, if the Blue Jays were thinking, oh, let's do a one-year deal here because all this money is coming up. And that would be an interesting way to kind of patch a hole in our rotation without shifting our long-term plans.
Yeah, I think, well, it sounds like that they were right there on Syndergaard. And you know, we don't know the shape of the contract that they were offering. And maybe Syndergaard, you know, preferred a one-year deal. And the Jays were like, no, we need an option or something like that. And you know, obviously the Verlander deal is one, but it's like one and an option. And it's kind of like $50 million guaranteed, which is a lot. But yeah, I think that definitely, that has always been my sense, is that that would be, you know, ideal for them and probably a way that they're going to look is to try to, like, you know, to get a guy who, like, to do a thing like they did with Robbie Ray and then maybe also play at the top of the market a little bit as well. But yeah, short-term money is definitely, well, they love, you know, they love agility. They don't want to lock themselves. They don't want to be, you know, whatever, like the Padres or the Nationals of recent years, you know, where you have a ton of really heavy contracts on the books. And at some point they may have to do that. This may be the winter where they do that. And, you know, ideally that would be really great, but they definitely value the idea that, you know, they can not remake the franchise every winter, but, like, you know, the team has, I don't know if it was Fangraphs, I forget who, but, like, the team has strong bones right now. And so you don't really have to do these franchise transforming things, especially because you already have, you know, Barrios now in the fold, Springer in the fold, Vlad Bo. Like, there's a lot here that, you know, that any way you go, any offseason, you're going to still end up with a really good team. So the idea, I think the appeal of short-term deals and I thought this winter would have been a really good opportunity for them because you have, you know, you had Verlander, who's now not on the market, in Syndergaard. There's still Scherzer left. You know, Zach Greinke's kind of washed a bit, I would say. The short-term guys are, the market for them is dwindling, at least in the free agency. There's other guys, obviously, you could find in trade where you would, you know, could take on a bit of money. But yeah, I think that that's probably the play for them. And I guess we'll see. I don't know, but I don't think that necessarily rules them out of Robbie Ray, for example, either, or any of the other top free agents. I know Atkins was saying at the Barrios presser, in an ideal world, they'd add two starters, and guys like Nate Pearson and Thomas Hatch would be, you know, have to earn those jobs. And he said maybe it'll be one, but it definitely sounds like they're going to add big league guys on big league deals to pitch in their rotation.
Yeah, I mean, arguably the best thing going for them from a roster construction standpoint right now is they've got kind of that NFL rookie quarterback contract thing going.
Right.
Where you've got the really young guys who don't make that much money, and then you pile on this is a very niche reference, but this is very much the 2012 to 2014 Seattle Seahawks, who built one of the best rosters in football, one of the best defenses we've seen in the last 20 years. They did that because Russell Wilson was a third-round pick making less than $1 million, and then they're able to sign all these veterans to short-term contracts while that was happening before they had to sign them to the big contract. And I think the Blue Jays see that to some extent. Like, you know, Vladdy's going to start making some money this year, but it's not nearly what he's going to make. Bo isn't making money yet. Like, those are two really All big stars. Pieces yeah. that you're yeah. that you're really you don't have to pay. So if you can slot in now, what you don't want to do. And I asked Mark Shapiro a question about this at a press conference a while ago about that idea of, okay, these guys are making very little money, and as a result, isn't it easy to kind of slot in big short-term money? And I think he sort of misunderstood it and wanted to say that you don't want to take sort of big contracts on the books because then maybe that prevents you from retaining them long-term and things like that, and that's all valid. But now is the time, And the time is running out. Like I said, Vladdy's starting to make the money now, but the time is running out to sign these short-term deals and fill in that roster around these young guys without restricting your ability to extend them. But this is one of the last years where they can really do that. And it's tough. It's tough to get pitching, especially on a short one-year contract, because if you're a pitcher, you want stability. If you're good enough to get stability, you want stability in most cases. So this is actually a weird offseason with a bunch of old guys where some of those one-year contracts were maybe in play, like with Verlander and Syndergaard being injury risks and whatnot. I don't know if that's still on the table for them. Like you said, that side of the market is kind of dwindling, but it is pretty much perfect for what they want to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm, you know, obviously there's going to be guys like Robbie Ray who they'll identify, you know, things that they think that they can help make them better, that, you know, maybe a John Gray is out there who that they like, or I don't know who they might like. There's still some guys who, you know, can absolutely on a 1 year deal that's relatively cheap, can fill out one of those two rotation spots that they would like. But it is going to be very interesting to see what they do in terms of long-term commitments, if they go for two guys, you know, a Robbie Ray and Barrios each making $20 million, and Ryu for another year, two more years. That's a lot of money tied up into your rotation, which would make it a really, really good rotation, as we saw last year. But it's definitely, I'm sure, thought of quite a lot over there.
And if you do that, you know, what resources are you putting towards that bullpen, which has been, you know, that concern? And there's a whole drumbeat for, man, they need to invest there because kind of going cheap and throwing a bunch of arms at the wall and seeing what sticks really hurt them last year. And again, it's so easy when you miss the playoffs by one game to be like, oh, well, that's what cost them the playoffs. But it's also kind of fair to say that's what cost them the playoffs. So invest like that in the rotation, what happens to the bullpen? It is going to be when the offseason finally sort of happens. And again, we're in a pretty ambiguous space right now. We don't know what's going to happen between now and December 1st. And is there still going to be transactions and before the pause? And what's the fast and furious nature of free agency after a lockout, presuming that gets fixed? We don't have to go through all of that. But the next time the Blue Jays are signing players, whenever that is going to be a fascinating time.
Yeah, I think absolutely.
All right, we will leave it with you there this week. Thanks again for tuning in, and hopefully you guys will join us again next Friday.
Deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market. Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.